If I really want to be a successful investor, I need to be an entrepreneur first.
My name is Esprit Devorah, host of the Women in Tech Show. The show means a lot to me. The reason why I wanted to create the Women in Tech Show is I wanted to create a positive piece of content, something where people can listen and say, if she can do it, so can I. I call it actionable empowerment. Every single episode, you'll hear the story of a fantastic woman in tech, from engineers to founders to investors to journalists to designers, all sorts of different females in tech who have thrived. I want to share their stories with you so that you can know what resources, mentors, and life situations they accessed in order to get to where they are today. Enjoy.
So my name is Inka Mero. I'm a startup investor, actually been working with tech for 20 years, and I work nowadays for a company that I founded 8 years ago. It's called Pivot5. We're a seed investor and accelerator company, accelerating both corporations but mainly globally growing startups.
And where do you focus? Like what geographic region do you focus on?
So Scandinavia and Baltics, this is really starting to become the hot tub of the European tech scene. So,
I think of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a great place to be. And when we started 8 years ago, of course, it was quite a different situation. But Finland, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, and then all the Baltic countries. So Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania.
So, and tell me, when did you first fall in love with technology?
Well, I was probably 18 and I was in a university. I was studying business, and somehow I got introduced to a thing called technology management and telecommunications as a MBA program, and that's how it somehow weirdly got started. I think on those days entrepreneurship really wasn't a choice,
right?
And everyone went to work for a big company. So did I, but I ended up actually working in corporate venture capital.
Because it's not as socially acceptable in Europe to be an entrepreneur like it is in the States.
Yeah, absolutely not, and particularly like 20 years ago, that was absolutely the case. So everyone was expecting you to work for a big corporation or in the investment banking or consultancy. But I went to work in corporate venture capital. So that kind of took me very close to technology.
It was like your gateway drug.
Yeah, it was. It was. And it was a really powerful gateway drug, because it even took me at the age of 24 to Tel Aviv, Israel, to found our operations there.
That's
so
awesome.
Yeah, I was working for a mobile operator, mobile carrier, and we were doing like internal startups, external startups, venturing, all of this kind of stuff. And so I went to Tel Aviv and I set up our operations there, which was pretty amazing at the point of time.
Like, you were working a corporate life, and then somehow you made your way to the entrepreneurial world. What was that pivot like for you? Was it really scary, or were you totally ready to dive in?
Well, I had started to work on venture capital very early on. So we had $350 million globally invested across Japan to Scandinavia to US and to Israel. And I realized at the point of 25 when I was that, if I really want to be a successful investor, I need to be an entrepreneur first. I need to get some real experience.
That's nice.
So, and I think that was because I saw all these, let's say, fast-growing Israeli tech companies at the point of time. Scandinavia really wasn't the place for role models, even though you had a lot of companies and tech companies and growing, fast-growing companies, and we had that first wave of tech companies at the point of time here. So I just decided to work for a smaller software, mobile software company called Digia that was doing mobile software for handsets. And I joined that company and very quickly became the global head of sales and marketing, so running the company sales. That was a really rough operational business school. So it was hardcore tech, like C++ kind of a coding. I was probably the only woman in the whole company. We grew to 500. And when when we grew to 500, there were less than 10 women in the company. Everyone was coders. So I really needed to understand what it takes to build a smartphone. And my job was to run the sales. And I heard afterwards that when I joined the team that there had been like betting ongoing that how long she will last. And the shortest bet was 2 months. And I was head of sales and marketing there for 5 years.
I knew you were about to say like years.
Yeah, and 5 years.
And what would you say your life calling is? Like, what's that one thing that you're just simply the best at and makes you feel most alive in your work?
I'm super good in building new businesses in terms of understanding how you transform, let's say, technological innovation into commercial execution. that's my middle ground. So I'm not a coder myself, but I'm not afraid to draw an, you know, architecture picture if needed. I'm not afraid to ask if I have to ask, but I'm much better, of course, in the commercial part. So building the business model, finding the customers, building a scalable business model, and you know, finding that early growth that is super essential for any startup.
And Pivot 5 is a venture capital group, right?
Yeah, it's actually an evergreen fund. So we invest our own money. We're a group of five serial entrepreneurs who've kind of joined forces. And we're more or less like co-entrepreneurs with our portfolio companies.
What would you say to someone that wants to become a female investor in the tech space? Like, what path? Like, think of like a 19-year-old in school. Somehow she knows about startup life. And one day she wants to be a VC like you are. How does she get there?
Well, you need to learn about the technology, and the best way to do that is to work in a company which kind of operates within that technology field. And it doesn't actually matter if you work even for a bigger company. I wouldn't say that just go to work in a very small startup. I'd rather say like go to work for a company that grows. So go and experience that super rapid growth.
Yeah.
And that's how you learn to do things in a quick manner, work with super fascinating people. You learn to solve problems. You learn to face obstacles and problems, but still get that attitude and ambition. And then you can obviously multiply that ambition across your investment thesis over time. So operational experience in tech is super important. The second thing is somehow building that strategic insight capability to any industry.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't just, you know, do spotted investments. You need to have some sort of a view how, you know, IoT landscape is developing, why certain company in renewable energy makes a lot of sense. Where is the asset value in, let's say, big data? So you need to have a view of that. So and you can't do that by just in the operational side. So you need to build that strategic thinking capability as well.
And one word you use is obstacles. How do you overcome challenges?
The obstacles really aren't the biggest thing in life. I've had more than 35 companies that I've invested into, seven that I've co-founded. I've been a CEO, I've been a chief product officer, I've run sales and marketing. So I think one of the key items is to realize that there will always be obstacles. That's part of life.
Right.
More important is that do you get things done? And how do you motivate other people? And how do you lead in difficult situations? And one way to look at it is just learning by doing. Second one is learning from people who are better than you are. And third one is, of course, finding your own way and path. And I think that's an area where women need to kind of a step up. So you can be super good in executing or getting things done, but you need to also create your own culture and your own values. And be very faithful to those. Nowadays, I see these startups where, you know, women are on the driver's seat. They're also quite passionate about, you know, how they want to do things. And I think we're starting to see very interesting companies coming over time from the tech scene, from this area as well.
Totally. Mm-hmm. You've had a lot of very established roles in your life, and a lot of people would find that intimidating. And I feel that though you now can say it's part of your past and you've done all these things, at one point you didn't know how to be a CEO or how to be a COO or how to be an investor. So where did you find that belief in self to just kind of lunge forward and do it anyway?
I think it comes from the family. To be honest, I'm the third child. You know, I'm the one who was never as good as the older brother or the sister. Right. But I had a lot of liberties, so no one was that interested. So I had more like freedom to operate. The other angle is that it's also ambition, but also, you know, the curiosity. I've been very curious to learn on things. I've never thought that I would not learn a thing if I would, you know, spend some time on it. So you're absolutely right. So I still take these leaps. I try to put myself into my uncomfort zone in a sense. So I work in a board of big companies. You know, it's pretty challenging to start work in the, you know, company which does traditional manufacturing, and you come from the tech background, but you need to kind of have this curiosity and willingness to learn. I think that's one of the big motivators.
Willingness to learn completely. I love it. And what would you say is something that you've learned about achieving your dreams? What did you learn about yourself in achieving your dreams?
One big thing was that I failed really badly once with a startup, and that was an e-commerce startup. Right. It was a bit comparable to what Fab.com did. We had a team in Silicon Valley. I was heading the product development here in Scandinavia, and we did all the mistakes afterwards, if you think about it. Like, you know, we raised too little money, we had a too high burn rate, we had too many locations, we didn't have the multidisciplinary skills, but the vision was great and we had a lot of drive and passion to do that. And failing on that was a big thing for me, like personally. But suddenly that failure kind of pivoted me to a completely new level. So it opened up me a lot of doors. Suddenly I was actually able to coach a lot of entrepreneurs in difficult situations. Suddenly a lot of investors came to us, like, what do you think about this case or this case? Because you have experience on this other area. So in a way, turning that tough experience into your advantage somehow requires that you're able to recreate yourself as well. And, and I've really gone that through. And that was also a time when I had my first and my second child. So I was like fundraising, pregnant, and breastfeeding on meetings and all of that. And now that I look back, I'm like, oh my God, how did I ever come around?
You see, so we actually have a story circulating around Los Angeles about women who are pregnant and fundraising. Did you experience any challenge in that?
Absolutely. It's much more difficult to raise money if you're pregnant. And I've done it twice. First, I did it for a gaming company. And then I was kind of a bit squeezing my belly in and smiling and not being very open about it. And just counting that no one will ever, let's say, challenge me on the topic. The other time was that I was very much pregnant and I couldn't kind of come around. But so I'll tell you a story. I went to a meeting. I was 5 minutes late to an investor opening my laptop and saying, like, I'm really sorry I'm late, or we're just about to launch, so this took a little bit more time. And he looks at my belly and says, like, I can see that you're launching. I'm like, okay, I'm not going to waste my time with this guy too long. But eventually, you know, I did the pitch and I left and he invested. So
I mean, I love that, because what I wanted to ask is, what are some positive solution-based things women who are pregnant can do to feel more empowered in meetings and not let the pregnancy have any kind of dictation on the investment or on the meetings?
Super difficult question, because it, on the other hand, you need to be also realistic and open about it. I think...
But I think that's one great thing. Yeah. You say just like, let yourself be.
Yeah, be pregnant, but also be open about the challenges. So I think the best thing you can do is actually bring in your own team, and the team is kind of very relaxed about it. And if the team is relaxed about it, the investors will be relaxed about it.
That's
as
a great suggestion. I love that. Mm. Anything else?
The second thing is like, okay, the investors obviously are probably a little bit hesitant to ask, but what happens if, you know, the baby is sick? What happens if something happens with the, you know, birth?
Right.
And these are the risk situations and the red flags that the investors don't want to run into. I think it's better to address those openly. You know, this is what we would do. This is how we would adapt our operations. This is our contingency plan, in a sense. And you need to be open about it, because otherwise getting that trust is difficult. And then, of course, let's say finding investors who have children themselves. You know, they might be very pro or against, but at least they have a view. Usually people who don't have children don't understand what it means to have children.
No, and I think that could go to the same with a lot of different types of companies. Like, I know there's this company in Los Angeles and they make nail art. So obviously they're going to have more of an understanding of what nail art is and how much nails cost to be done in a salon with a female than they would like a guy that's never had his nails done.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
So I think the relatability comes into play in a lot of different areas, male or female, of just kind of taking control and of your own life and like being proud of it and just delivering with confidence and conviction that you're the person to get things done.
Yeah, and the other angle is that nowadays I think it's completely okay to build these lifestyle and value-driven companies. And I think you can, as a startup, differentiate a lot by giving flexibility for women to work while having small children, and also, you know, men as well. In Scandinavia, the men take care of the 50% at least.
They do?
They do. Most of them do. It's, you know, this...
They, like, the men in Scandinavia don't have jobs, like 50%, and then they let... And the women have the career?
No, but from the children. Yeah, so we really split the work.
Oh, the responsibility of the children is 50-50.
Yes. Yeah,
oh,
the responsibility of the children is 50-50. And, but in Sweden, for example, the parents share the maternity and paternity leave time. And that actually creates more career possibilities for women when they apply for jobs, because then the employers don't think like, okay, whether she's going to get some pregnant or not.
Totally. Have you had a mentor? I mean, it's a very difficult journey to achieve as much as you have. Like, who have your mentors been?
I've always been the female frog among the, you know, successful men. So there's been a lot of people who've been giving me advice, probably for many reasons. But I've been really lucky to have, like, great bosses and colleagues. You know, a lot of talent, little ego kind of a men. And that's been one of the biggest drivers. And nowadays, I try to build these relationships. For example, I've recently started to hunt.
Right.
And hunting? Hunting is a little bit of this kind of a hobby that a lot of people who work on public boards do. It's a kind of an outdoor sport. Right.
Heads up when you... Yeah, sorry. I can hear. Yeah. No, it's okay.
It's
hard, yeah.
So it's an outdoor sport, and I was originally thinking, like, let's see it. And then I decided, okay, I'll try it out. If I like it, I'll start doing it. And I'm really an outdoor person. I love to be in the forest.
Right.
And so
this is crazy to me. I'd never go hunting.
But the experience, in a sense that you actually walk with someone for the full day in a forest...
Oh.
Gives you an opportunity to talk about very personal
That's interesting.
Things. So it's a completely different way of connecting than to go to a restaurant.
Right.
So I try to do these things with smart and influential people. But nowadays, if you look at the people at Slush, these young talents, I think I actually learn a lot from these guys as well.
Let's talk about Slush for a second. Why this event so important?
I think the way the event is being generated is unique and very unique in global terms. Everything is run by students. You have more than 2,500 volunteers who just, you know, die to work in an event like this. It's really about building the community and the event for the entrepreneurs and the founders, getting the globally leading investors and all of them here. And it's really accessible. So I was just... at the backstage after my panel, and I was kind of chatting with the Crown Prince of Norway.
Amazing.
Hello.
Yeah, and, that's amazing. Yeah,
and he's like chatting about startups and so forth. And, you know, then there is a, you know, CEO of Nokia who's like very relaxed and no problem.
Right.
So it's also the mentality, how things happen. And I think Slush has become a global phenomena. We've now experienced Slush Tokyo, Singapore, Shanghai. We've done, you know, initial tours in Africa. So let's see where the journey will take us.
And how has Slush supported women in tech?
All the way. So you know that the CEO of Slush is now a lady, Marianne. She's 24.
Yeah. And if I understand correctly, she's only the CEO for like 2 years because Slush purposely rotates the executive team every 2 years.
Yeah.
And then the current team trains the team. And that's part of the community building.
Exactly. So we build and embrace the talent. So Slush is owned by Startup Sauna Foundation, which is a nonprofit foundation. And I'm in the board of that. And we even rotate the board members. So this year, my 2 year will come an end. And I will have to recruit someone who will come and work for pro bono and for the community.
Oh, so interesting. And so even the board members
rotate.
Like everyone rotates. Yeah. That's incredible.
But then we have a lot of these seats. Slush is one thing. Startup Sauna Accelerator, which is the biggest accelerator in Northern Europe, is also under this whole thing. And then we have like Startup Life, which is a student exchange program. But coming back to women, last year we kind of had an issue that there were much more men-driven teams. Women tended to be the ones who took care of marketing or HR or finance. And we started to really openly talk about this. So last year when Slush happened, I said to all the kind of a core youngster team members, I said, like, now it's time for a female CEO.
Yeah.
And I'm so happy that they eventually came to the conclusion that we have a female CEO. And she's a role model. But we also have a female team running the Startup Sauna Accelerator. So, you know, it gets more than 1,500 applicants per year, and we coach, our batches take a total of 30 companies. So it's tougher than Stanford.
And tell us a little bit about the Sauna Accelerator.
So Sauna is...
It's part of Slush.
Yeah, it's part of the Slush, let's say, entity, or Slush and Startup
movement,
Sauna. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it initiated at the same time as Slush. We wanted to build functioning ecosystem to Scandinavia, one startup at a time. So what we do, we fly around the world, we do more than 50 local events from Vladivostok to Budapest. We go on and work with local entrepreneurs and the community. We source the best companies to Scandinavia. Two batches a year, 15 companies each. The best companies get to go to Silicon Valley and to London and to Berlin to meet early stage investors. The best thing is that you have access to guys like Ilkka Paananen, the founder of Supercell, or Niklas Stenström, the founder of Skype. So all of these serial entrepreneurs actually come and really work with our startups. I was head coach of that for 2 years, so kind of that was a little bit history in the past that there was a female head coach, right, and so forth. So it's been like, you know, this whole community, but it's for pro bono. So no one, you know, it doesn't take equity. The whole community is involved and everyone benefits. It's the VCs, yeah, it's the angels, the startups, the alumni. And just to throw you one figure, I think we have now 250 alumni. They've raised more than 300 million of capital.
Incredible.
And it's really growing. So today, actually, we have a demo day. So you need to come and see the
Definitely.
Companies.
How can people find out more about that? What's the URL?
So it's startupsauna.com.
Startupsauna.com.
Yeah.
Awesome. And do you have someone, that, like, who's that one person who really inspires you? Like a woman in tech that you're like, oh, she's just so amazing. She blows my mind.
Oh, there are so many.
And it could be an engineer, a founder, a product manager. I mean, it doesn't matter who.
One of my inspirations is a young lady. And she's quite famous globally, a lady called Linda Liukas, if you've heard of her.
Mm-mm.
So she's a... She created this initiative called Hello Ruby, so really teaching girls to code. So
That's
they
great.
Had Rails, and the initiative was called Rails Girls. So they started
Rails
to initially,
girls. Yeah.
So they started to create workshops for girls to start coding and making, you know, internet and technology more accessible. And she's really been true to her own identity. She loves the storytelling. She loves dreaming. She's very, let's say, girly. And I love it because even myself, I tend to be a little bit, let's say, manly in a sense. Because,
right.
You know, it's a very men-driven environment.
Yeah.
So sometimes, you know, it's important to have these high heels and dresses and feel like a, you know, woman. But for Linda, she's really done her own way. And I really appreciate her for that.
Awesome. And I know you guys are listening to the music in the background. Slush has this huge presentation stage with like a fire pit and everything. And it's like a celebration of the person about to come on screen. So I think they're switching out speakers right now. So you guys get to hear the excitement. Thank you so much for spending your time with the Women in Tech podcast. Like, it's just really important to see that there's these amazing females like yourself out there truly achieving whatever we want to achieve.
Thanks. Yeah. I really appreciated the chance to be talking with you today.
I know, that's great. Wait, you guys, seriously, we're in this small, we're like so smushed together like sardines in this small like phone booth looking thing so that we could give you the audio quality you deserve. If you want to hear more incredible women in tech, go to womenintechvip.com. That's womenintechvip.com. That takes you straight to our Facebook page. And of course, you could always tweet us at Women in Tech Show. This is Esprit Devora, and I will see you guys, talk to you guys in the next episode. Bye.
This episode of the Women in Tech Show is powered by UpGuard. UpGuard's discovery engine brings visibility to complex IT environments, enabling teams to quickly identify risk, confirm compliance, and make business safer. They are proud supporters and employers of incredible women in tech. To be notified every time a new Women in Tech episode is released, simply text Women in Tech to 310-872-2423. That's 310-872-2423. To support the Women in Tech Show, it's super easy. All you need to do is start doing your Amazon shopping by clicking on this link first, womenintechshow.com/Amazon. That's womenintechshow.com/Amazon. The Women in Tech Show is hosted by Esprit Devora, edited by MKW Films, show notes provided by Carl Marty, music by Jay Huffman Live. The Women in Tech Show is a WeAreTech.fm production.